All right, we are ready to proceed when you all are ready to proceed. Ready?
Yes, Your Honor, we are.
Yes, Your Honor.
Our clerk will call the second case, please.
The court will now call City of Benton versus Ryan Russell et al. And may I please the court, Mr. Jerry Drake, the argument for the appellate, and Mr. Brian Cartwright, the argument for the appellate.
Good morning. May it please the court. This is an interlocutory appeal that's based upon the governmental immunity of the City of Denton. And there are a number of facts that could potentially bear upon this case at trial, but the issues before this court really don't depend upon the resolution of those facts. It's a case of whether the sole basis for arguing an exception to governmental immunity applies in this case, and that is section 271 of the Texas Local Government Code. The claimed waiver doesn't apply here, largely because there is no contract. Certainly, there are services that were performed, but there was no contract, the essential terms weren't stated, and it was not properly approved. To start off with, I think we're in agreement, although Mr. Cartwright pointed out that I didn't specifically say with regard to summary judgment cases that the standard of review is de novo standard, and that I believe it's essentially the same. 271.152, it's not a contract. What we're talking about here is a policy manual. And there's a specific policy in there that talks about payment for on-call time as opposed to standby time. I'll go ahead and tell the court for the purposes of context, we believe that what we were dealing here was standby time, although people commonly called it on-call. But at any rate, it doesn't matter because, again, it was not a contract. It didn't state essential terms. That there was no authority to enter into a contract. There's an ordinance that the City Council passed sometime earlier that's in the appendix that specifically limits the city manager's authority to enter into contracts of employment. Certainly not with the plaintiffs here.
Mr. Drake, what I'm hearing you say is that your contention is there wasn't a agreement or meeting of the minds between the City of Denton and the people who are working for them to have an employment arrangement.
No, sir. What I'm saying is that there was no meeting of the minds regarding the application of that specific method of payment with regard to these employees.
Isn't there an employment agreement whenever a person applies for a job and when the city says, yes, we will hire you and we will pay you?
It's an employment agreement that's an at-will agreement. And one of the things that I'm going to get to in just a moment is the disclaimer that was made up front. But generally speaking, the parties to a contract can change the terms at any time. And if one party doesn't like those terms, they can terminate the contract.
Well, I'm just concerned that you're saying there's no contract when my interpretation of what happens with a person hiring on as an employee, even if they don't have a written contract, is that you hire me, I'll work for you, you pay me.
I understand, but it not specific to the terms that are at issue in this case. There was no written contract that said that you will be paid according to these terms for particular work that you do.
And you're insisting there should be a written contract or the statute doesn't apply?
That's correct.
How can you say there's not an agreement when you look at page 5 of 5 and there's an actual chart telling you how to compute the time and the pay?
Because that chart shows how to pay it if it applies. And one of the things that's provided in that policy is that directors are given authority to decide whether or not they're going to implement
it. So these individuals just voluntarily decided to be on call?
Well, I think that what they did in actuality was to take turns who's going to be the person to be called in case there is an emergency. I don't think it's an on-call type of thing. I think it's...
If that's the case, weren't there sanctions contained in that same provision that if you weren't available and you didn't respond, that there would be sanctions imposed against the employee? And weren't some of those sanctions actually imposed against the employee? So it's enforceable for you, but it's not enforceable for them?
Well, I think that, for that particular time period, that could be the case. But as far as an ongoing contract that would, survive the entirety of their work with the City of Denton, I don't think that's the case, because I think that, again, the contract is disclaimed. If they want to have a contract, they can ask for one. They probably won't get one, but they can sure ask for one. They can leave if they find it intolerable to not have a contract of employment. That's the nature of employment at will.
For not being available because their cell phone is dead, but they can't get paid for being available.
I think that if it's applicable, they could be paid. But I think that for a number of reasons that really aren't before the court right now, that it's not applicable.
If it's not applicable, how is it applicable for you? You can sanction them.
Well, I'm not even arguing that point on appeal, Your Honor.
I'm just asking you the question.
I understand, and I think that may be a very relevant question for the trial court to ask if we get to that point. But I don't think we are at that point. I think that what we're really at is to see whether or not there's even jurisdiction for the trial court to reach that issue.
Well, going to your disclaimer part of contractual terms, that specifically just talks about employment, and the policy that we're looking at is wage and salary plan, response time, and on-call duty. So aren't those two totally separate things?
No, Your Honor. This is policy 1.00, which applies to the entire policy manual, including 106.
So you can have an at-will employee that has a provision that they're going to be paid this much, and... You're saying that, I just don't understand your position, how an employment, the right to terminate employment equates with this wage and salary plan, response time, and on-call duty.
Well, let me skip ahead. If we go to policy 1.00, there's really three things in there that I think are important. One is saying in big, bold capital letters, this is not a contract of employment. Nothing in this policy manual shall be construed as a contract of employment. That's a big red flag right
that
there.
That shall not be construed as a guarantee of continued employment with the City of Denton.
But it also says that it's not a contract. It also states that it's an at-will relationship and that the terms can be changed at any time. And that's very important. And there are a couple of cases that I can refer to that are not briefed here. I only discovered them yesterday, although they existed. One of them is the Worden case, 28 Southwest 3rd, 649, out of Corpus Christi in 2000, and the Gamble case, 932 Southwest 2nd, 253, Texarkana case, 1996. Both of them are no writ history cases. And those are actually termination cases, and what they point out is, I'm sorry, they're not termination. They have to do with benefits, whether you get paid for vacation and sick leave. The argument was that we are entitled to be paid for a certain amount of vacation and sick leave, and we've been relying on this. That's what your policy manual says. That's what we've been working under all along. And the courts in both of those cases said no. You don't have that because of this disclaimer here. The fact that you have this disclaimer means that the terms of your employment can be changed at any time. When these plaintiffs got their first paycheck after serving what they thought was on-call time, and they saw that they weren't paid for it, that's a pretty good indication that there's certainly a dispute over whether what the terms are and what the applicability is. And so they have an option. They can continue to work for the city and accept those terms of employment, or they can quit. And that's basically what the Word and Gamble cases say. I've got copies of it for the court if you'd like, or we could brief it further however the court wishes. But it was harsh in those cases as well. I could certainly feel for the employees in those cases that they think that they're going to be paid for accrued vacation and sick leave, and they find out, no, you're not. And there's a certain harshness in that, just like there's a harshness in governmental immunity to start with. But that's the law of the state of Texas. And I further go through the analysis to say that whether you want to say that it's a contract or not, it's not a contract subject to 271.152 because it didn't identify specific services to be performed in the state of essential terms. Even the Williams case that the plaintiff cite has a number of terms that they say must be present that really weren't identified here. By the way, Williams and most of the cases that the plaintiffs cite appear to be civil service cases where there was a collective bargaining agreement, which I think is entirely distinguishable from the case here. There was no proper execution. The city manager was forbidden from entering into employment contracts by resolution of the city council. That's resolution 96-022. That's in the appendix. And the city council can enter into contracts on behalf of the city, but absent some kind of a delegation of authority, that doesn't go down any further. There's no authority to pay for services that are already performed. Again, when they got that first paycheck where they didn't get paid what they expected to be paid, that's their indication that something's amiss. You don't just rat hole that and wait until you get a big claim to bring it forward. You address that right then. And if you cannot accept those terms as your employer is putting them forward, your remedy is to look for employment somewhere else. That's the nature of employment at will. It works both ways. And I don't get paid on-call time either. It doesn't apply to all employees, and we all know that. We all know that it doesn't apply to all employees. One other thing that I think is very important from looking at the policy manual is there's nothing in there that gives any kind of vested right to employees. There's nothing that says that as of a certain time, you have earned something, it cannot be taken away, what have you. That's part of the cases, particularly the Worden case and the other one that I alluded to earlier. When the boss says that's not what it means, your remedy is say I quit. I think that one of the things that I've heard Mr. Cartwright argue over and over again in the trial court is you can't change the past. But what I would submit is that's precisely what the plaintiffs are trying to do. The city passed all of its policies, all of its ordinances, all of its resolutions that bear on this case in advance, and they indicated that. But they're coming back and saying, we've got all these years that we want to claim here. To me, that's changing the past. And I will turn over the microphone at this point unless there's any questions.
May it please the court.
Cartwright.
Counsel. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Brian Cartwright, and I represent the appellees in this case. The appellees are employees of the City of Denton. We are here today because they are asserting that they have a vested right to back pay, specifically pay that they were promised to be paid upon the performance of certain services, which were in fact performed and were in fact accepted by the city, the appellant. Now, Your Honor, in the almost 30 years that I've been practicing law, there have been a number of cases, not very many, but a number, where I just sit back and I say, this is obvious. Well, that is always followed up with that moment of paranoid reflection when I ask, then what am I missing? Well, this is one of those cases. You see, I don't understand legally or logically how an employer can set out, say, you will perform services, or I can fire you for it, tell you how much they're going to pay you for those services, accept those services, and then turn around afterwards, throw up their arms and say, not only are we going to not pay you less, we're not going to pay you at all. Now, I've known Mr. Drake for a number of years. He's a very good lawyer. I believe that he has done as good a job as you possibly can with the facts that he has been presented to him. But I'm going to tell you right now, the city's position does not make sense legally or logically. It simply doesn't make any sense. Now, there are three points that I would like to bring up. The first basically involves the argument about the city resolution, stating that, well, the city manager doesn't have the authority to enter into contracts. Well, first of all, I don't think that that's what the resolution says. I believe that it discusses certain contracts that he can enter into. But what we're talking about here, Your Honor, is not a bilateral contract. We're talking about a unilateral contract. So the question in this case isn't whether the city manager had the authority to enter into a bilateral contract. The question is, did the city manager have the authority to promulgate and implement the personnel policy that is in place in this particular case with the executive committee's approval? And that answer is absolutely 100% positively yes. In fact, the city doesn't even contest that the city manager has that authority. If we look at the city code, Your Honor, section 2-28, it expressly states that the city manager is delegated the authority to promulgate and implement personnel policies, to and including, which includes this particular policy, as long as it's approved by the executive committee. And that's exactly what happened. So that is the issue in this case. Was he authorized? Absolutely. Did he do it? Absolutely. Were services performed pursuant to that particular policy? Absolutely. So why then does the government, the employer, then get to turn around and say, well, we're just not going to follow it because we don't have to? It doesn't make any sense. Now, the second thing that I would like to focus in on, Your Honor, is the Panigua case. Now, obviously, before I go off and sue a governmental entity, I learned early on. Matter of fact, I can tell you the year that I learned that you don't really sue governmental entities unless you are absolutely positive that you feel like you are right. 1995. Now, what I learned from that case was that not only are governmental entities protected under the law, they're also protected by the juries. Because I believe after a day and a half of keeping that jury out, they told me, you know what, we believed your case, but we didn't want our taxes to go up. Now, from that case, Your Honor, I have learned since then that I pick and choose a case against a governmental entity very carefully. So what I did when I said, well, this seems obvious, and I asked, what am I missing? I went and I did my research, and I came up with the Panigua case. still asking myself in that paranoid moment of reflection. I then went to the city before I ever filed a lawsuit. Tell me what the issue is. Well, I didn't accept what they were saying, so I filed the lawsuit. They then filed a motion to dismiss. Now, they submitted evidence. I withdrew my objections to that, even though they weren't allowed to present evidence. I said, let's let a jurist who has many years on the bench, who happened to graduate Order of the Coif from Texas Tech University, tell me, what am I missing? Well, he denied their motion to dismiss. They then turned around and filed a motion for summary judgment and a plea to the jurisdiction. I didn't ask for a continuance saying, you know what, Your Honor, oh gosh, I've got to go take all of these depositions to see if I'm right or not. Well, they presented that position, and again, the jurist with many years of graduating Order of the Coif from Texas Tech said, you're still wrong, and now we're here. You know, I've been asking myself the question, what am I missing? And the answer to my question has clearly become, I'm missing nothing, because I am absolutely convinced I am right. Now, obviously, if you disagree with me, I will listen to you, and I anxiously read, await your opinion. But on the same token, I just don't understand. Now, they have argued the Panigua case, and their big point on this was is there wasn't a disclaimer in that case. But we have to look at it beyond that. This was an employee of the city of Galveston, a manager who was basically on standby for his entire career short of about 2 weeks of vacation time. There was a city rule and regulation, basically a policy and procedure that had been passed by the city council that said that anybody who serves 7 consecutive days, does this sound familiar, gets 5.5 hours of overtime. And then this is how we're going to calculate it. Does this not sound very familiar as to what 106.6 states? Well, he was not paid that amount, so he had to file suit. He included an FLSA claim, so it was removed to federal court, a magistrate tried it, and then the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit is the one who actually decided the case and reviewed it. The issue, as it was framed by that court, was whether there was a contractual intent of the city to compensate, and remember, to compensate employees for standby time pursuant to this rule and regulation. And they cited 4 essential reasons for that. The first one was is that the terms were embodied in rules and regulations, exactly what we have here today. By placing the terms in the rules and regulations, the second point, the city intended to compensate the employee pursuant to that rule and regulation for that standby time, exactly what we have here today. It also stated that the compensation language was unambiguous and it was mandatory, which is exactly what we have here today. Now, the city stands here and tells you that, well, that is very ambiguous. We can't figure out what exactly we're supposed to be compensating for. It says on-call time. It defines what on-call means. It says if you're there for 7 consecutive days, 24 hours a day, this is how much you're going to get paid. And, oh, by the way, it's just like the Panigua case that said that you will receive. Well, this one says you will be compensated. And in fact, that very policy even says, this is our policy on how we're going to compensate you for performing this particular service. They even say in their brief, well, it's not a service. Well, service is defined as an act that is performed for someone, and in the context of employment, for pay. My clients literally could not go to their children's sporting events if they were too far away. They were chained to being within 30 minutes of that call. And if they didn't, guess what happened? We had a situation, Calvin Patterson. He got disciplined. This isn't just a minor inconvenience. This wasn't something that, well, they were just sitting around watching TV, going anywhere they wanted to, go up to Windstar, do a little gambling. This was something that significantly impacted their ability to live their lives. And now they say, well, we don't have to pay him. Makes no sense. Now, the one thing that they're latching onto is the fourth factor. And it was based upon the facts that were presented in that particular case, Your Honor. They say, well, there wasn't a disclaimer. So suddenly they say that because there wasn't a disclaimer, that is dispositive of whether Panigua applies to this particular case. And we respectfully disagree. In fact, number one, if we look at the Panigua language, the issue of there wasn't a disclaimer was the very last thing that they relied upon. And their very last statement was, it simply reinforces the magistrate's decision. It doesn't say that it was dispositive or that if there had been a disclaimer that it would have changed everything. And we know, actually, that the disclaimer is not going to be dispositive, particularly in this particular court, because thanks to the city, they cited Brown versus Sabre. Now, in that particular case, they rely upon that for the proposition that suddenly this court has decided that there is an overall policy. If there is a disclaimer in an employee manual or handbook, guess what? Automatic King's Act. There cannot be a contract, period, paragraph, over and out. Well, that isn't what this court held. What this court held in the context of that particular case was that an employment handbook, or policy and procedure in this case, does not alter the status of an at-will employment. Notice, does not alter the status. Doesn't have to do with compensation, just has to do with, does not alter the status of an at-will employment, in particular when there is a contractual disclaimer clause and when that handbook or that policy can be changed whenever it wants to. That is significantly different from this case. And in fact, if you even go farther, the Second Court of Appeals, this court, specifically said, do you know what? There are very limited circumstances in employee handbooks or policy manuals can otherwise form enforceable promises. And do you know what the first case this court cited to support that was? Panigua. That leads me to my last point. And that has to do with the disclaimer clause. Now, the appellant is arguing essentially that if we have a disclaimer, it is a magic wand. It suspends all reality and all common sense and all law. It doesn't create a contract. There's no way that it can. That's absolutely not the law with regards to disclaimers. And here's how we know. If you read the Panigua decision on page 1314 on footnote number one. It discusses what a disclaimer actually is, and it really has to do with if you look at a separate provision under an employee handbook or a policy and procedure in this particular case, then the question is to look at the disclaimer in terms of whether that separate statement in the employee handbook is sufficient to overcome the presumption that an employment contract is terminable at will. That's the purpose of a disclaimer. And in fact, if, as you pointed out, I believe, Justice Walker, that policy number 1.00 really does have to do with that. That's what it addresses. And in fact, the trial court in open court even mentioned that as I read this policy, it just looks like it's trying to prevent a change of the at-will employment status of these employees. It doesn't have anything to do with what the appellant was attempting to argue. Now, as I've stated in our brief, and I will continue to maintain this, we are not asking you at all to find that my clients are not anything other than at-will employees. We are not asking you to change their employment status. What we are asking you to do, though, Your Honor, is to recognize what the law of employment at-will contracts are. You see, from what I hear the appellant saying is that, well, an at-will employment contract, that's just too bad. We can do whatever we want to. It's not enforceable. That is not the law of the state of Texas. In fact, in the Sterner versus Marathon Oil case, a Texas 1989 case, it expressly held, an at-will contract is enforceable until it is terminated. Well, nobody had terminated our contract, Your Honor. None of them had been terminated. An at-will employment relationship only means either side can terminate at any time for any reason, as long as it's not a protected reason, religion, race, something along those lines. It does not mean, and this is from the Panigua case, an express quote, does not mean an employer can promise to pay an employee a certain wage and then unilaterally decide to pay the employee less for work already performed. It cited the Pickle versus Brooks case, which found at-will employees have a vested property right to the salary and wage benefits that they are entitled to for the time that they have already worked. Your Honors, that's what this case is all about. So when I ask myself in that moment of paranoid reflection, what am I missing? The answer is quite simple. Nothing. If you have no other questions for me, Your Honor.
Quite right, I have a question for you, and yes, I'll direct you to the question I asked counsel for the appellant. I ask if it's position of the City of Denton that a separate written agreement is required in order for 271-151-152 to apply in this case? And he said yes. And then you've got a whole plethora of cases cited on page 18 in your brief in which the jurisprudence in this state has gone off to state that that's not what's required, because the case law and supportives, including the Paniquas case that you're talking about, states that if you've got written policies, you've got written ordinances, activities of a city, and then you have people hired in accordance with those, then you've got a written contract. Now, did I miss that?
You nailed it.
So when we're talking about a written contract in the definitions section of 271-151, case law in this state supplies that support for your position in this case.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's for these reasons the appellees respectfully request that you rule in our favor, affirm the trial court's decision, and remand this case for further proceedings. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Rebuttal, Mr. Drake.
Your Honor, with all due respect, not only to the court, but to Mr. Cartwright, who I also respect very much, I think the reason why he doesn't get it is because he's looking at this too broadly. I don't think we're here to debate what the law of the state of Texas is with respect to at-will contracts in general. What the city has challenged is whether or not we have a contract subject to the subchapter as defined in 271.152. That is the narrow issue. That is the part that I think that the appellees are missing here. And I think that if we look at the terms of the specific waiver of immunity, the limited waiver of immunity that the Texas legislature gave in that case to get around things like federal sign and other such cases that people thought were just unimaginable. They gave this very limited waiver of immunity here. I heard Mr. Cartwright say the city says they won't pay him at all. No, they got paid. But, you know, there was a legitimate dispute as to whether or not they were subject to overtime pay. Again, a fact issue for the trial court if, in fact, this court holds that that this is a contract subject to the waiver in 271.152, but not an issue that addresses the governmental immunity. As far as Paniagua is concerned, that was a Fifth Circuit decision, and that court, of course, is required under the Erie Doctrine to accurately apply Texas law. And the cases that have been cited by the appellant here all post-date Paniagua. Now, there's no opportunity to go back and change the Paniagua holding in that case. But I think that the subsequent Texas case law that discusses the law with respect to employment manuals and disclaimers is clearly at odds with what Paniagua says. And again, as Mr. Cartwright pointed out in Paniagua, they also raise an FLSA claim, which is not present here. And I'll just go back to kind of the last point that Mr. Cartwright made. For the disclaimer, is the effect of a disclaimer to suspend common sense? No, absolutely not. Is it the effect of a disclaimer to limit remedies that are available? Yes, and that limitation of remedies is something that all city employees, including myself, live with. We know that we have limited remedies available to us that the folks at Sabre Incorporated might not have. And so I think that that's what this is about. When you're dealing with governmental immunity, you have to hit all the wickets. You have to hit the terms of the limited waiver that the legislature provided. Those wickets are not hit in this case. There is no basis for a waiver of immunity under 271.152. Thank you very much.
Greg, thank you, Mr. Cartwright. We appreciate your arguments here today. Your case is submitted, and you are free to go about your business.
Thank you.
Are you okay to continue on?
Yes, I am.
All right, Ms. Simmons, if you need to check in with the clerk, that would be great, and then we will take your